welcome to another edition of the Corner Store Podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Koval, and excited to have you tune in to today's episode because it's a big one. We have in the Corner Store a gentleman who has put on for independent music, both in Chicago and around the planet, the founder and owner of Smart Bar and the Metro, someone who has really been a tireless advocate for new and emerging artists in the city and beyond, who has literally built a home for independent music from all genres, and just is a giant supporter of mine and the work that I do as an artist and the work that I do at Young Chicago Authors. We are honored to have Joe Shanahan in the Corner Store. Welcome, Joe.
Can you just see me blush right now? I mean, geez, thank you, Kevin.
No, man. Thanks for
having me. I appreciate it.
I'm so glad that you're here and love talking with you always.
Yeah.
Appreciate the opportunity to have you in this space and to go a little more into your story.
Sure. We just picked up where we left off.
Yeah, exactly.
Seems to be our thing.
Before we go anywhere, though, I want to, we give all of our guests some snacks in the Corner Store
because, okay.
We want to make sure folks are fed. And I know, you know, like myself, you are a health conscious gentleman. And so, you know, we got some sticky rice chips for you. It's the coconut crunch flavor. These are pretty good.
Oh, okay.
Actually, I like these snacks. I was thinking about myself when I was, getting your snacks. And then also some smoked maple strip salmon filet. It's like a salmon jerky.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, which is also pretty good. Good proteins.
Oh,
in
that's
there.
Great. That's great. It's epic.
And yeah, exactly. Enjoy, and we like sound effects on the Corner Store. So
the Corner Store, yeah, I guess I'm in the Corner Store.
Exactly.
So we got to have snacks.
Exactly. Yeah. Precise. So yeah, man. So I know that you put on for and love this city a lot. Mm-hmm. I kind of want to go back. I mean, just where you come from, where
originally, Evergreen Park. So that's the, Evergreen Park High School, Most Holy Redeemer Grammar School. I still say grammar school. Parish, I still say that.
Wow,
too.
Yeah.
But Beverly is like kind of like the place. I think that, I still go to Beverly. There's a lot of great art happening out there, a lot of great people at the Beverly Arts Center that are doing some cool things. With music and spoken word, but yeah, so my South Side roots are deep, and I still feel that they're part of my DNA. And as a matter of fact, I was just there last weekend seeing John Langford do a parking lot and raise money to save a building.
Now, what did your folks do in Evergreen Park?
Well, let's see, my father was a traveling salesman, and
that's quite a gig too. I mean,
he was on the road a lot.
Yeah.
What
was he selling?
He sold textiles. He worked for a textile company. Mm-hmm. And my mother was a nurse's aide, and then she worked for a catalog company. But she raised six kids, so I'm from a family of six, kind of sort of in the middle there. I've got two younger and then four above me.
That's quite a squad.
It was, and she kept pretty busy with babies, I have to say, because
she had six of them.
So yeah, right. My brother Paul, who I'm really tight with still, is 10 years younger than me. So, and my brother Bill is only 2 years younger than me. So it's almost the Irish twins. And then I had a sister Sally, and a brother KJ, and a sister Mary. And so that was all the way up the chain.
Oh, my God.
But, yeah, I love the whole idea that, I went and spent a lot of time in New Orleans and spent some time in New York, but Chicago is really my home. I love the people. I feel the work ethic is something that's part of my DNA, and just going back to the South Side this past weekend was one of those things where I just kind of walked around. I went to my favorite pizza haunt and went to one of my favorite ice cream stores, and they're still there. I was like so happy they were still there.
Mm. And of course, I want to talk about why you chose to make a home here, both for yourself, your family, but also as a career. But before we get there, what was, you know, when, how prominent was music in your life? At what point when you were young? I mean, when did it become a, you know, when did you notice that you're like, oh, well, actually, I'm gravitating toward this.
It had to be sort of my love of Motown and kind of like the early sort of Beatles and Stones, because that was sort of like what my brothers and sisters, my older brothers and sisters were listening to. WLS radio and WCFL and WVON. I mean, these were radio stations that we listened to all the time. My father was more into jazz and blues, which was a good thing because I think I learned a lot from what he was into and how that sort of really affected me as I grew older. I was never afraid of like, oh, I know who John Coltrane is. I know Miles Davis is, you know, Ornette Coleman. Yeah, he's weird, but I like him.
Was that weird to have a dad, like an Irish Catholic dad from the South Side, be so into that kind of music at that time?
I mean, it's what he listened to him. And then yeah. My mom loved big band, you know. Mm. So, you know, it was like I hear these stories growing up that my mother and father, my father was in the Navy. My mother was, I guess, like a nurse's aide, and there was this like the story about them going to the Aragon Ballroom and dancing to, you know, Benny Goodman. And I'm like, it's so cool. I love the fact that my mom and dad did that. So like when I went and DJed, I opened up for the Clash. You know, I told my mom, I'd say, I'm working tonight. She goes, where are you working? I go, I'm going to work at the Aragon Ballroom. Anyways, she almost started crying. She was like, well, I used to go dancing there. Is it the same? I said, it's absolutely the same. It's like this beautiful Moorish, you know, Spanish castle. I get to talk about that kind of stuff with my parents.
That's pretty special. That's beautiful. That is a pretty big deal that you DJed for the Clash. So I know now we're jumping ahead, but how did...
Wait, let's go back.
Okay,
Because there's a really good piece about how I discover music, and it is because, and maybe even the first DJ sort of thing, is that I used to have a small, like, portable, like, record player, and I set it up in the garage of my home in Evergreen Park, and plug it into the electric socket in the garage, and started playing 45s. And my sister's friends, they're all real cute. They would be hanging out. You know, she's a few years older than me. So her friends would come by, and I'd be like playing, you know, Diana Ross and the Stones and, you know, Marvin Gaye and, you know, sort of the Beatles. And it became like my own little version of like my first garage sort of like house party.
Yeah.
And I was this young, cute kid, you know, just playing 45s. And that's how it started for me, is that I realized I liked doing that. I liked making people have fun, dance, smile. And I didn't necessarily have to be in the midst of that. I could actually just kind of be, maybe I'm a little shy. I wanted to stand back and watch it happen. And I started a collection. I started collecting records at an early age.
Where would you go for records?
In Evergreen Park, there was a few record stores. I remember I worked at one of them. It was called Lowe's Records. It was in the Evergreen Plaza. There was another one called Tempo. So that would buy records from those locations. I started my collection. I still have some of those records, actually. I'm proud that I didn't like lose them all in the enormous floods that my stuff went through. We all went through at a certain time in our lives, because all we could afford were garden apartments with, you know, two other guys or three other guys, and that's what you did. Right. But yeah, I still have those records, and I'm proud that I started collecting records. I'm really still collecting records. I still buy vinyl almost every weekend. I stop at a record store in my neighborhood and go through, and oh, there's an Etta James 45. I want that one.
What has the collection gotten to now? Do you know?
It's big.
Numbers?
It's big.
Yeah.
I don't know. 40,000 maybe.
Wow. Okay.
It's growing. I stopped counting.
Yeah.
I just began to like. And
how do you catalog? I mean, in what ways do you arrange it? How is it cataloged, I guess?
Some of it's like there's like a whole dance sort of collection, because back when we started Smart Bar, it was my collection. I mean, I basically just volunteered my collection because I was one of the first DJs.
What year is this, by the way?
82.
Right.
But so from like, let's say from 79 to 82, I'm at Wax Trax a lot. I'm at Gramophone a lot. I'm at Imports, etc. a lot. You know, I'm going back to the South Side too. You know, some of the crate digging out there a little bit too, because a lot of it I wanted to find. You know, I love funk and soul. I still do. But I would blend that into like what I thought was kind of tighter, you know, modern interpretations of that from New York, like ESG and some of the early hip hop sort of sounds. You know, honoring James Brown and honoring Sly and the Family Stone right there, along with, you know, anything off the early Sugar Hill days, you know.
Yeah.
Sequence or, you know, Fab Five Freddy.
Well, so I want to get to that part, because I've heard you tell some stories about early days of Chicago electro music.
Mm-hmm.
But so take us from the garage. You know, you're a kid spinning 45s essentially for your sister's older cute friends.
Mm-hmm.
But you
and my friends too,
and your friends too. but you follow this idea, of course, throughout the course of your life. So where does it take you next?
You know, I think that once I leave Evergreen Park and I enroll in design and art school in Carbondale at SIU, chose that school because of one particular person, and that was Buckminster Fuller, was actually a professor, and he still was living, and he was in Carbondale. So I was like on a sort of a mission to be closer to what I would consider my personal modern day thinking Buddha.
And what drew you to him?
His look at life. You know, he was a modern, adventurous thinker, and he was supremely talented as far as like his blend of art and science. I mean, the man invented the geodesic dome. You know, I knew that from like the World's Fair. I was like watching what this guy was doing. He was talking about the future. I was listening to David Bowie. I was the Ziggy Stardust, and there was Buckminster Fuller, the living actual adventure. He had the future. The Tomorrowland was Buckminster Fuller. And so I was following that muse a bit, got down there, studying photography, studying design, studying art, and tending bar to sort of get by. You know, I come from, small beginnings, and my mother and father didn't have a lot of money for me to go away to school. I got myself a scholarship. I got myself a grant. I delivered newspapers for most of my life till I could have some bread in the bank, and still collect records. But that's when I started like spinning records down there too. It manifests itself again another way. So while I could still play Stones, Beatles, Motown, I then began to play things from, you know, from England that I was really falling deeply in love with. And that would be, number one, the band The Clash, because I love the fact that I understood what reggae was, because I was already into like the Wailers and already into Bob Marley and Peter Tosh and sort of what was coming out of Jamaica. I knew that was important. So it was, again, this another aspect of art and culture that, you know, I was able to, you know, just easily glide into, and I realized the thread. So I would play the Ramones and I would play the Sex Pistols, but I was always leaning more towards that sort of like underpinning of like reggae, and The Clash were a big part of that, you know, and anything that kind of came from that.
This is the mid, late 70s around this time?
So I graduated high school like 75, 76. So yeah. I'm in Carbondale, you know, so 1977, and you know, that's the year, you know,
right.
That's when punk rock, you know, broke, you know. And you know, so it was, you know, I'd made the sojourn to New York, you know, I'd gone to CBGB's, you know. It was an important, you know, sort of something was happening in our world that I was old enough, if I figured it out, how to figure out to get a train ticket or a plane ticket, or even hitchhike. Back then, I used to hitchhike. I can't even believe that I'm saying this. I hitchhiked to New Orleans from Carbondale once, twice actually. But that was the thing, you know. It was like I felt there was a glowing ember of new and emerging art. It was my age. I mean, the Ramones were my age,
right?
You know. And I was going to go see them at CBGB's. The Talking Heads were my age. I am going to see them perform. Patti Smith, a little older, but still part of that thing. I mean, it comes out of that whole, you know, it was Lou and David and Iggy, you know, as far as the masculine trinity. But Patti Smith was just as important to me, and still to this day, I mean, I'm a huge fan of hers. I just saw her at Riot Fest recently, and kind of received the gospel from her, so it was felt pretty good about that.
Well, I like this idea that you are also a futurist, which makes sense given what you've done and what you continue to do, and that you're kind of chasing or in tune trying to track down what is that new and future sound.
Yeah, I'm foraging.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's a big garden. It's a big forest.
Which is what a DJ does, right?
Oh, yeah,
is like,
for sure.
That's in some ways, that's one of the primary aspects of the gig.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. You know, I remember this gig that I did at the Aragon Ballroom. I opened up for The Clash, and now I'm going back to that story.
Yeah.
Because I was playing some music that obviously resonated, because the band's manager came up to me after and said, how do you know about this music? Because I was playing like Liquid Liquid and like, again, ESG. I was playing a lot of that 99 record stuff, and I was playing some early sort of Paradise Garage tracks and a little hip hop, and then throwing in sort of like, I wasn't really like playing like the new wave. I wasn't playing like the B-52s, and I think I played Rapture by Blondie, things like that. You know, it was like, it was, you know, it got people like they were recognizing it, but it got back to the band that there was some cat that was, you know, laying something down, and they were like, well, where are you going after the gig? And I said, well, I'm going to go back to my club, and you all should come with me. And The Clash came to the Smart Bar.
Wow.
And we stayed open all night.
Wow.
And it was great.
So that's obviously already after you have created it.
Yeah.
But I mean, I want to, so you, if you were bartending, you mm-hmm. started to get indoctrinated, you started to see a nightlife, you know, and that nightlife sometimes also, you know, filters into the music scene.
Sure.
But at what point did you come back to Chicago and start taking what you were doing and bringing it out into public spaces?
I realized, because I had kind of a floating party in Carbondale, and then it sort of landed in a bar called Silver Ball, and it was a pinball like bar, and it had a small music space, and I started doing some punk rock nights there, and like, you know, cheap beer, maybe have a band or two play, local bands. It's just kids just making noise. And then I'd play records that, you know, I'd bought either in Chicago early on, you know, record stores that were, you know, like Rose Records had a really good record buyer, and Mike Rivers, I believe, was his name. And I would go, and I would take the train or another, this is a good one, Kevin. Another little business I had was that my roommate and I, we had a station wagon, and we would undercut Amtrak by like about $10 and then drive people from Carbondale to Chicago. And the money that we had, we'd like rent like one hotel room and go to La Mer Viper and go to the Aragon to see the Ramones or Lou Reed. And so I was doing that on weekends between classes.
You were Megabus before Megabus.
I was Megabus. And we would drop cats in Cabrini Green. We'd drop them in Robert Taylor Homes. We were just like, we put the sign up in the dorm or in the student center. You know, like if the train was $40, we went like, you know, 35 or 30, you know. And it was just like, Because it was like, back then, you know, $5, $10 was a big deal.
Yeah.
Still is.
Yeah.
But we did that. It was like a little, I was my side hustle. And, yep. And maybe that's been part of my whole life, is that whether I was delivering newspapers or doing my Megabus. But it was coming to Chicago, buying records, going to the clubs, going to the bars, and realizing at one point that Carbondale had just sort of ended for me. You know, Bucky had moved on, passed actually, I believe. And I'd gotten enough of that from my experience in Carbondale. I also had a really great couple teachers down there that were really into keeping me sort of in the photography and design sort of frame of mind. And then I came back and I enrolled in Columbia College.
And did you graduate from there?
No.
Okay. Didn't graduate at all?
No. Didn't graduate from college.
Yeah, me neither. It's okay.
But as you know, our good friend and collaborative friend, Bob Tidal, and I were actually, we were given our honorary doctorates.
That's right.
From Columbia That's College, right. You know. I guess it's turned out pretty well for
Should
us.
Should I call you Dr. Shanahan? Do I need to do that?
You, from now on, you do. That's exactly right, Kevin. From now on, I expect it. You know, actually, the guy that I work with, Dave Flood, who's like the building manager, we've been playing. It's so funny. He always calls me doctor before the PhD or whatever. But I call him captain because he's got a boat and he calls me doctor.
Nice. You're a doctor.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I will do that, you know, henceforth. You at some point, so you bring your talents and you bring that sense of throwing a party, creating a space to Chicago.
Absolutely.
What are some of the first spaces that you go to that you're inspired by? What are some of the places that you're looking at that point?
It was a super creative time because for me, I was one of those kids that, as I said, because of my upbringing on the South Side, I wasn't afraid of black music. As a matter of fact, I loved it. So for me,
was that an anomaly? Like being an Irish Catholic South Side kid, were you not supposed to? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
How do you navigate that space as a white kid? Telling,
I just did it, you know.
Yeah.
And you'll love this, and I hope that people listening will love this, because really, what Smart Bar and Metro is and became was, because of those early days post Carbondale, I was hanging out at La Mer Viper, which was the greatest,
Where was that?
Halstead and like Wrightwood, or Webster.
And what was it? I don't even know. I don't know.
It was a gay bar.
Yeah.
That had a punk rock night, and it was so successful, it just became a punk rock bar. And this guy named Noah Boudreau was like sort of the bartender and kind of the manager, and he had these like performance art things happening, and again, guys like Mike Rivers, Sparkle, Taco, these cats that had like the best record collections, and they were playing reggae, they were playing punk rock, they were playing Motown. It was, I had found my tribe. I couldn't believe it. I was like, I'm never going back to school. This is my classroom, and it was like that was it. But the other piece of that, at that same time, the Warehouse was open.
Yeah, so like, this is one of the most important cultural spaces in the history of the city. But
no
tell
question.
Us, tell us what it was like. So first of all, tell us what it was, and then when was the first time you went?
I think for me it might have been one of those. I think I was at the record store, Imports, etc., and I think I stumbled across this record bin, and it said house music.
Right.
And I was like, oh, what's this? And they were like, well, that's the stuff that Frankie spins at the Warehouse. Who's Frankie? Oh, Frankie Knuckles. Wow. So
had you heard of him prior to that?
Yeah, I had because of like the sort of, you know, again, the sort of the gay community, even through La Mer, you know, they knew about what Frankie was doing on the South Side. Southside, Jefferson, and you know,
right,
Clinton,
yeah, you know? Very, very near. Downtown.
You think about it now, it's like, yeah, it was downtown. He had a downtown club,
right?
And La Mer was a Northside club. So, you know, in a way, I think those two, that juxtaposition of both those really important moments in club culture here in Chicago had such a big influence on me. But going to the warehouse was one of those things. I remember like working late, and I worked for Arnie Morton, and I worked for the Arnie's and Morton's and a couple of his restaurants. And we'd get off at like 2-3 in the morning, and I'd be like, oh, I know where to go. And I would say, some of the waiters, some of the gay waiters, some of the straight waiters, you know, some of the girls, we're like, let's go to the warehouse. And it was welcoming, though we were, you know, certainly eyeballed.
Because you were some of the only white folks?
Yeah, but yeah. But also the great thing was is that some of the boys that would go with us that were gay. So it was like it was a gay club, you know. Right. So there was this sort of like feeling that and at that time, you know, the music began to sort of the complexion changed a little bit, in my opinion. I think everyone talks about the disco demolition, you know, the Steve Dahl thing. And it was, you know, a point of this, it was embarking in a new direction. It, thank God, disco went back underground because that is where, you know, it lived. Mm. And house was a big part of that sort of underground thing. So in a way, if you knew about the warehouse, then, you know, you kind of belong there. If you didn't know about it, you weren't like looking it up in the reader. You know, they weren't taking ads. You know, it was like it was a word of mouth thing, right. And you went with someone that either had been there or wanted to take you there, and that was my case as well. So, but Frankie was like the draw. He was the flame. We were just drawn to it, and my personal thing was that I used to sneak in a little bottle of, back then the big vodka was Stolichnaya. It was like a Russian vodka, and I'd put like a bottle in my boot and get it past the front door, and I'd make him drinks. I'd make drinks for him, and he'd just like, who is this kid? Well, how did you get this in here?
How did you also come to know that that's what he, how did you, because you went on to have a relationship with him, yeah. But even from that beginning did you know that?
I just showed him the bottle and said, you want one? And he'd be like, oh yeah, I'll have a drink. You know, so he had his orange juice back there, his grapefruit juice and ice. And the next thing I know, maybe month or two later, you know, I was invited back into the Inner Sanctum. I was able to sit back there and go through the records and look at the records.
Wow.
And actually at one time, this was like kind of like my moment with Frankie, was that he said, pull some records for me. And I pulled some records for him. And there were other people in there that were like, oh, wait a second, that's my job, or that's like my gig. And I think that Frankie and I knew something, we had something in common. So hence when I opened the Smart Bar, the first night of Smart Bar, I hired Frankie to kick the door open, and never looked back after that. My relationship with him through thick and thin, you know, it's really, I'm really grateful that I had such a close relationship and a professional, and we did some things that, you know, yeah, still felt to this day, you know. You know, now I just miss them so much sometimes, and I think about them, yeah. Because that music was just so important to me, and I knew it at the time. That's the thing, you know. You can listen to all the songs you want, but in the right party, in the right setting, you know what it feels like, and when it feels like that, you don't want to go anywhere, and you'll stay till noon. I mean, it was like one of those things. You just like, I don't want this to end. World, pause. Everything pauses, and you're there, and you feel it. So he was able to do that for me with a great sound system, with wonderful people working around him, like Frederick, and who I'm still friends with. And, you know, Frankie and I developed a professional relationship where he became a resident of Smart Bar. And, you know, even when he got sick and couldn't travel as much, you know, he had a regular gig with us. And, you know, that meant money for him, and that meant something more to me, because I just looked at him as so iconic. So
you still keep his picture in the DJ booth.
Absolutely.
In the Smart Bar.
Sure. He's one of the heroes.
Yeah. No, it's beautiful. Well, so it's interesting because you going back and forth between the warehouse and the punk club.
Yeah, on Lemaire.
On Lemaire. Mm-hmm. In some ways, that not only are you doing a lot of crossing individually, aesthetically, mm-hmm. sonically,
yeah. Yeah.
but this is ultimately the kind of space that you've now built. You know, the Smart Bar, the Metro, is also in one space,
yeah.
a crossing.
But I saw no difference between ESG and the Talking Heads. Mm. And I think Frankie knew the same thing. And I think a lot of DJs back in the day, there was a guy named Ja that used to spin around. And Rick Radio Faust, who I believe just recently passed, he was another one that, like, reggae and punk were kind of, they were synonymous. Because they were both kind of like these challenging sort of like non-traditional or non-mainstream styles of music. Well, house fits right in there too. So the thread was turning into a rope really quickly. And I was like, come on, who wants to help pull this? Who wants to pull this wagon with me? And I was so surprised. There were so many people. On our opening night at Smart Bar, it's thousands of people. I was just like, oh. Wow, we're really onto something here. And it was alternative. It was alternative in the sense that it was an alternative space, alternative music, and alternative people. Again, as I found my tribe at Lemaire and at the warehouse, all of a sudden there was another whole group of people that had been really never served. You know, they were going to places or maybe not going to places. You know, they're hanging out in their houses.
To go from collecting, playing, even throwing parties
yeah.
to them building a space is a big leap.
Yeah.
How, you know, what gave you the chutzpah, I guess, to just open? You just knew you wanted your own spot. I mean, it's interesting that you were in the restaurant business, you know, as a, you know,
yeah.
bartender, server.
Sure. I mean, service industry's, you know, really important. I do believe in that whole sort of Bob Dylan sort of, you got to serve somebody, you know, you don't, I think it's an important thing. My children, Tara and Michael, have both done it. I think it's important that you do that. You know, I mean, Harvard should teach kids to go be a waiter, you know, before you turn them into corporate lawyers.
There's something about being in the arts and being in the service industry
yeah.
in that way too.
Yeah. But I'm just saying, I think that there is this, when you work closely with people like other waiters, other bartenders, I mean, there's a real team sort of thing, and people are kind of treating you poorly, you know? I mean, I think that that comes with that, just in this part of its network. I think it's important that the work ethic that I found amongst local DJs, local bands, and local promoters, I found it to be so energizing that I just said, okay, I'll sign a mortgage. I'll go on the limb or on the, I don't want to go on the lamb. I want to go on the limb. And I'll rent this space. I'll put, you know, X amount of dollars into, you know, a dubious landlord's pocket and hope that I can make it a year. And it was really, I hope I can make it a year.
Right.
And then, you know, the first band you book because you went to New York and you saw them play a little club, REM is the first band you book. Then you go, oh, wow, there's 500 people that just showed up for a band that is way under the radar. Mm. You begin to realize that there's something happening there. And those guys were sort of my pulling guards and tackles, you know, because they spread the word that Metro was a good place to play and that, you know, Metro team was an honest team, and that residual effect really helped get us off the ground.
I mean, you've been instrumental in so many careers, not only in Chicago, but around the country, around the world. But I mean, just even in Chicago, you know, from, you know, the Smashing Pumpkins to Chance, I mean, and genre agnostic, just, mm-hmm. you know, you've
good word.
Put on for and given the stage and the space to so many folks that continues to be representative of that incredibly diverse ear that you have.
I think, yeah, Well, thank you. I don't know if it is as, I mean, I really feel very strongly about, you know, I will work as hard as someone who wants to work alongside me. So when you meet someone like Patrick Corcoran, who's going to work really hard, you're like, oh, so I like Chance. He's cool, but who's his team? And it's like all of a sudden then you realize like, oh, okay, this is going to be not just work. It's actually going to be some fun too. There's something that everyone begins to feel, you know, all oars in the water. We're all going to row the same way. You know, I mean, I feel the same way about YCA when we do the block party in January. It's an unsurmountable, crazy day.
Yeah,
but it's like lift, yeah. So rewarding. I mean, all those young people, you know, being served, and quite honestly, we know that they're underserved. But I feel really strongly about like bands like Twin Peaks and Whitney, and I've watched that happen. And I really feel really strongly about artists like Jamila Woods or you know, sort of in that range of like where are they coming from next, you know, you know, even Lewis the Child, which would be considered to be a local artist, you know, they cut their teeth with us early on. I think that Metro is a great launching pad. There's not a lot of pretense. I think that the staff is I'm there, but the staff is
incredible.
Really what makes it all really go.
Such good people.
I mean, I look at like Rexall and I look at Joe and I look at Jason and I'm like, you guys, amazing, you know? And I think that's community and I've been able to serve that community and it's not just the making of the money. It's because the other part of it is, how do I get people paid? I really enjoy the fact that I can turn around and pay someone really well.
Right.
Because I think that's when I'm really doing my job.
Yeah. I mean, both staff.
Right.
Artists.
Right.
Promoters.
Sure.
I mean, there is, you know, the Metro has been a central focal point of an emerging, growing Chicago indie music scene.
Yeah.
For now going on, what, four decades?
37 years.
Yeah.
So we're going to turn the page to 40 soon.
Yeah.
And, you know, you got to also remember, celebrate that building. That building's pretty special.
It's beautiful, yeah.
Because there's no windows. It's all wood and plaster. They just don't make those like that anymore. I mean, a lot of places try to build those places to make them feel and look like those places, but it's not.
So what was it before you took it over?
Swedish Community Center. It was literally a neighborhood community center for the Swedish community that lived in that area. There's three of them, I believe. One in Andersonville, one in Wrigleyville or Lakeview, and then there's one in the near north, like by Division and LaSalle. And it's an area of buildings that you would get information about green cards, about jobs, about insurance, housing. And it was a community center. And, you know, I think that I wanted to keep that flame lit because there was a new community that needed to be served. And, you know, when the early days of like, you know, even like Afrika Bambaataa, the first time he came through Chicago, he played with us. And then Black Flag. So we had this thing that was like, it was sort of like, you had Billy Idol one night, you had Divine the next night, then you had like, you know, Husker Du coming through. And so I think that that's that whole, it was a blender, but a lot of faces that I would see would go to all of it. It right. wasn't like, you know.
Yeah, that's part of the magic of it, yeah, right?
It wasn't just, you know, if you say agnostic, it wasn't just like one following.
Right.
It was actually pretty cool to see that sort of that blend of things.
Yeah. But I think what I admire so much is that it also is representative of your ear and the kind of, you know, I mean, it's reflective of the culture that you build, the community that you build.
Yeah.
Which is very powerful.
Yeah.
You have managed groups here and there I don't know if you do that much anymore.
I kind of stopped. My daughter was born, and then I was kind of drafted to a tour in England with the band The Smoking Popes that I was working with at the time, and I missed several weeks of my daughter's life, and that I came home and I said, I'm never doing that again. I admire managers that and men and women and families that can do that, but this wasn't for me. I'm proud of my children, proud of my 30-year relationship with my wife, Jenny. But, you know, I still, you know, Kevin, I am a fan. This is what comes down to this, is I am still a fan. I'm a fan of the written word. I'm a fan of records. I woke up this morning. I listened to a record this morning. You know, I mean, it's like,
what'd you listen to this morning?
I listened to Miles Davis, Birth of Cool. Mm. And it was like my yoga time. And it was the one side, which is amazing. You think about it, like two sides of a record back then was probably about, you know, 32 minutes or something like that. You know, it was like a 20-minute workout for me. But yeah, I think that, you know, I love to start my day with music. I sometimes end my day with music. After watching the news last night and just getting my head full of all the political garbage that's out there, I put on the James Brown Talking Loud and Saying Nothing. And I was like, this fits today, man.
Well, I mean, even before we were on air, you were just telling me about your schedule in the next few nights.
Yeah.
And you're constantly going out and seeing and hearing and not only supporting artists you've known, but hearing artists that many of us have never heard of.
Right. Well, I think that that's part of, again, the foraging that I still enjoy. And it's not just like sitting in front of the computer and, you know, YouTubing this and that or you do have to go see certain things live, because I have learned that some bands are actually really better live than they are recorded. And I think that the live communal music experience is something that cannot be digitized. You have to be in the room for it. And, you know, through a really good PA and through with like-minded people around you, you may end up with like an absolute unbelievable experience. One of my favorite things about going to Metro is that I can be in the office and I hear a sound check and I go down and check out sound check a little bit. And I think to myself, I'm going to have some dinner. I may want to stick around and to see the first couple songs. And maybe a band I know, maybe a band that's maybe coming back into this. And I get down there and then I can't leave. And I'll call Jenny. I'll send her a message saying, I'm stuck. You know, the Melvins just blew me away, and I'm not leaving until they're done. You know, it's like, you know, one of those kinds of things, you know. And it's happened with, like, you know, someone like Sturgill Simpson, or it's happened with, like, Jesse Ware. And so I never know when it's going to hit me, but when it hits me, I'm not moving.
You got to pay attention.
I'm paying attention. Yeah. And then I'm telling people about my experience with not just discovering, but going, hey, I was at that show, and, you know, this Princess Nokia girl, she's got it going on, and we got to keep an eye on her. Let's see what happens.
I want to talk about the future of Metro Smart Bar. I also want to delve a little into and lament the passing of Double Door. Mm-hmm. Especially because, well, a few reasons. One, you know, I just put out a book about Wicker Park in
the 90s.
Thank you. And but also because the Yeti store just moved into what was one of the most important independent music venues in
the
city.
We used to do the, you know, the YCA.
Yeah,
you know?
No, I mean Jesse's Blue Groove Lounge. So many experiences inside of that space.
John Legend, Kanye,
right?
Jill Scott,
right?
Sonic
it had
Youth,
a different vibe.
Smashing Pumpkins,
and it had a different.
Hey, how about this one? Rolling Stones,
right? Right.
I got to work with the Rolling Stones.
But they just like pulled up on you. How did that happen? I know that because that's like an infamous night.
It's a good story. But finish your thought, because I think that Double Door, 24 years of my life,
right?
different sort of scenario than Metro, because I didn't office in Dumbledore. So, you know, people like Lori and Sean and Nate and Chris and Mark and all these great, you know, Danielle, all these great people. June ran the door. I mean, since day one to the last night. I love that cat.
Yeah.
Shout out, June.
Yeah.
But I think that was a big thing, was that, you know, I had a scooter. I used to do a show at Metro, then take the scooter across town and do Dumbledore. And I did this for about, I'm going to say, at least 10 years. It was, and, you know, Dumbledore opened the year my daughter was born. And so that's one of the reasons why I stopped managing bands, because I also had this brand new project that I was absolutely in love with, that building, in love with that room. I still just kind of kick myself. I should have bought the building, but the guy wouldn't sell it to me.
Right.
It wasn't, and when he wanted to, it was just too much money, you know. And, you know, I wish Brian the best. I don't have an axe to grind with the guy. He needed to take care of his family, and I get all that. But when the sign came down,
yeah,
that was really hard for me.
Must have been a hard day.
Really hard for me. You know, my friend Tony Fitzpatrick, our friend Tony Fitzpatrick, another civic incredible, giant, you know, artist that I've been following and supporting and loving, you know, since the first time I saw one of his drawings. You know, he did a double door drawing, and he gave that to me, and I still have that. And I look at it every morning. It is where, right above my turntable at home.
Wow.
So, yes, it's a piece of my heart that has been taken. I have so many good memories of that building.
Yeah.
So many good memories of that.
Yeah, so do I. I mean, it was such an important space. It was such an important space in that neighborhood.
Oh yeah.
But
timing too.
Yeah, right. Exactly. In the mid-90s. Time that you right.
You know?
Yeah.
It's kicking off down there.
Yeah.
You wanna hear a great story?
Yeah, please.
So the day we go to look at Dumbledore, Sean and Andy then invited me down and take a look at this project. And I was like, okay, fine. So I drive over in my little Jeep Laredo, you know. Because we had a little family on the way, and so I pull up my Jeep and pull in front. There's a parking spot, you know. There's like a meter. I put my money in, you know, and I go in. I hang in with Sean and Andy, and we're figuring out where the stage would go. And it's like we're gonna do it. Let's do this. I come back out, and I'd left some like cassette tapes like on my seat. I came back out, and not one but two of my windows were smashed. And I look, and the woman that the dry cleaners was next door, and this woman was standing there smoking a cigarette, and I'm like, I go, hey, did you see what happened? She says, welcome to the neighborhood. And I was just like, oh, that's tough.
That's real.
I go, I was too yuppie with my Jeep, you know. I was like, I'm just gonna come here and get people jobs. It's gonna be fine, you know. But she was just like, big puff on her cigarette. Welcome to the neighborhood.
Yeah, no, it was that was wicker in the day. For
all
sure.
Good by me. Still to this day, great story.
Amazing. Do you want to tell the Stone story?
It's been told a bunch of times, but
you don't have to.
You know, I can just say this. You know, it was one of the greatest moments. And one of the hardest moments is it wasn't something that just happened. It was something that took days to come together. Cause I had shown the Stones team several venues. They kind of came to a friend of mine, Scott Gelman, and he was working for Jam Productions, and he was kind of involved in that aspect of it. And another gentleman by the name of Jerry Barrett, who was a promoter in Toronto, and his company was promoting the entire Stones tour. So there were a couple factions of like who was involved, but I think it was basically like sort of like, you know, Keith Richards' manager, you know, that wanted a certain kind of feel and vibe. So I, you know, of course, number one, you know, let's go. Checkerboard, you know, or you know, Buddy Guys, and all. Too predictable. Okay, fine. So then it was like, how about Lounge Jacks, cool, small, hip groovy, not big enough, a little too small. Then I was like, oh, little bigger. So now I'm rubbing my hands together. I'm like, Metro. And I showed them. They said, no, too big. I go, what? I go, what are you doing to me here? So like, and then it was like on to the next one. So it was sort of like after like about, I don't know, seven different places. I was just like, hey, you know, I got this cool little shitty little fun bar in Wicker Park that, you know, we're just kind of getting it going. And I don't know. It could be a good option, but because you're saying things are too small, I don't know. You tell me. Let's just go. They walked in and they were like, this is it. And I was like, oh, dude, this is great. Except for they needed us to build out the stage so that Bobby Keys had a place to stand. And they had, I think, a keyboard player, too, that had to have Chuck Lavelle, I think, Bobby Keys had it. So my friends at DB Sound, Tommy and Harry, were like, we'll all build it out. And I go, yeah, they're going to build this thing out. And as it began to come together, I realized that, you know, it was going to be one of the best moments for me personally, because I was that kid in Evergreen Park playing Satisfaction and Under My Thumb and Get Off My Cloud, you know, in my garage, and there they were in front of me. I was going to get to work with them, and it was like conversely as exciting when, you know, the Ramones played Metro or when Joe Strummer played Metro. And so like I look at these moments in my life and I'm like, I am one of the most, you know, blessed people on the planet that I've been able to do the things that I've been able to do and work with the people I've been able to work with over, you know, 30 years. But the Stones thing was interesting because it was very democratic, and the fact that everyone paid $5 to get in, and there was just this little sign on the side of the building, tonight, Rolling Stones. And people were like, it's a joke. And then they walked up and got a wristband for $5 and were coming back that night. And, you know, it was just like, you know, Keith Richards kind of like, you know, eventually figuring out kind of like who I was, inviting me down into his dressing room, into his room, because Mick had his own, Keith had his own. And I think this is more of a Keith gig, because that's just what I take from the whole thing, is that he loved doing these kinds of things. And he says, you know, my friend Paul Natkin, the photographer, taking a photograph of us. And he's like, what would you like to drink? And I'm like, you're asking me what I want to drink? Because what do you feel like? I go, you know, I see you have Guinness there. Let's have a Guinness. He goes, I love Guinness. So we're having a Guinness together. And there I am sitting drinking with Keith Richards and thinking about the gig that's going to come, you know. And I go, you know, I just kind of take away from that. That again, I was just as lucky as anyone could be on the planet.
Yeah. Well, that's beautiful. Well, you know, I am sad that the Double Door is not there. Of course, the Metro is there and continues to do incredible work. We were talking before about your Sunday night program.
Oh, yeah. Queen. Oh, best party in town.
Right.
Once again, something happened and all of a sudden this great community of DJs, drag queens, promoters came together and said, let's just have the best party in town, and it's going to be Sunday night, and it starts at 10 and goes till 4, and there we are, you know, people lining up to get in, again, a very safe space. People feel, you know, like it's a place they can let their hair down. Whether, you know, you're gay or straight, you know, binary, doesn't matter. It's just, it's a good, fun, you know, experience. I will say a big shout out to Michael Serafini and Derek Carter and Derek and Garrett David, who are the musical sort of components, the residents. Again, back to like residents. I mean, we love the fact that we're able to create like these nights around these DJs. And our residency program is something that Jason Garden and Sev Delbalar have really worked hard on to cultivate and to support. And we know that our community supports it. But Queen is one of those really, really special. I mean, just hitting on all, you know, six cylinders. And it's a fun thing. Come on out and enjoy it.
what is the future like for you? I mean, what is it, 37 years in, you know, no sign of really, I mean, you have so much energy around this work. What is it? Yeah, I mean, as you're staring at the 40th year and beyond, what does the future of the Metro look like for you?
You know, again, I just think that, you know, I'm still a fan, and I still enjoy music. I still enjoy, you know, discovering something under a rock, you know. Just discovered this new kid from Dublin, David Keenan. He's played at the G-Man Tavern, first time in America, you know. And like 30 people came to see him. And there's something special about him. I don't know what it is. I just can tell there's something special. I think that the good thing is that, you know, we own Metro, you know. I don't have a landlord. I have a banker who's a terrific guy and comes to shows. You know, I think the civic aspect of Metro is really strong. Smart Bar as well, and G-Man Tavern. Yeah. Because I think that I began to look at and say, you know, that's important to me. The future, you know, I still feel there's a void for, you know, a 500 or 600 cap club. I'd love to approach that again someday. I don't know when and how. The right building, the right situation will present itself. Because remember, the economics of a smaller venue is really tricky. You don't have the kind of volume in alcohol or ticket sales that really can support like a bigger staff. And we like to do it the right way. We were really fortunate at Double Door. There were people that were so into the mission that they sacrificed for certain things. But the future, I still think, is, you know, right here in Chicago. I still feel between DJs and between, you know, promoters, and I'm learning something, you know, on a regular basis on who's out there doing certain new music and new bands. I just keep my radar clear, you know. I still travel to New York. I still travel enough around this great planet to pick up on things. But the great thing about now, Kevin, is that so much just comes to us. I mean, that's something that's happened because of 37 years, is that now Metro people, they, managers, agents, bands, they come to us. Like, I'll get something from someone, you know, and check us out. And there's a lot of that.
Yeah. Well, you continue to inspire and, you know, just really create essential spaces, I think, for artists from multiple genres to remain here too.
Yeah.
And so, you know, as my people would say, you know, you're a real Minch, and I appreciate you, and I appreciate this conversation so much. Yeah. Okay. Just thank you so much, man. Thanks for for everything.
Sure. And,
you know, personally, but thanks so much for this conversation, and thank you being in the Corner Store today.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Shout out our super producer, DJ Cashera. Big up boss man, Todd Manley. Thank you to our official Corner Store photog, Mercedes Zapata. Salutes to the Snack Door, Max. Also, please, y'all, follow our Instagram. It's corner_pod on IG, on Twitter. Tell us who you want to see in the Corner Store. And also, please consider dropping a couple of dollars into our Patreon account. It's patreon.com/cornerstore_pod.
The Corner Store is brought to you by Stolen Spirits.